Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present retired CIA officer Ray McGovern, who reflects on the issues at stake in the open conflict between the CIA and Senate Intelligence Committee over its investigation into the Bush administration's post-9/11 torture program. Ken Bossong, executive director of the Sunday campaign, who discusses the key role of energy issues in the current East-West conflict in Ukraine. And John Boniface of the group Free Speech for People, who considers the constitutional amendments advocated by retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens proposed in his new book. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Solar panels now dot the historic buildings of Freiburg, Germany, as the city, dating back to the 13th century, has become the epicenter of Germany's transition to clean energy. Germany has made a commitment to generate 80% of its electricity with renewable sources by the middle of the 21st century. Yet the commitment to Germany's clean energy transition comes with a real cost. The nation currently has among the highest electric rates in Europe, and manufacturers are screaming for rate relief. The German government has granted energy surcharge exemptions to energy-intensive industries in order to prevent an industrial exodus to countries with cheaper rates. And while most German citizens remain supportive of the transition to renewable energy, many poor residents can't afford the high electric rates and are relying on support from charitable organizations to pay their utility bills. Germany's clean energy transition calls for renewables to make up 35% of the country's power by 2020, up from 25% today. Combined with ambitious energy efficiency goals, carbon emissions are projected to fall 80% by 2050. Outside of scenic Moab, Utah, energy prospectors are staking claims to exploit shale oil and tar sands along the Book Cliffs East Tavaputs Plateau. The area is estimated to have the potential to produce three times the proven reserves of Saudi Arabia's, but developing it would be environmentally destructive. In much of Utah, energy developers of non-conventional oil must work with the Federal Bureau of Land Management, who supervise over 3 million acres of public land in the state. In many western states, pro-mining legislatures, including Utah, have tried to take over management of federally run public lands. The logical result would be greater exploitation of natural resources than under the Bureau of Land Management. Ken Ivory, the Utah State Representative who authored the 2012 Transfer of Public Land Act, worked hand-in-hand with the right-wing American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, which is bankrolled by the billionaire Koch brothers to push similar laws in Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, and Nevada. Clinton-era BLM Director Patrick Shea noted that the aim of the law, which a federal court last May ruled to be unconstitutional, was, quote, to sow chaos on public lands. The Environmental Protection Agency has walked away from a fight over the cleanup of a former Florida phosphate mine due to pressure from state officials and the powerful phosphate industry. The EPA is turning over the site to state officials and has declined to designate it for Superfund cleanup status, despite their own internal documents that reveal that agency officials believe the site posed serious health risks. Critics say the EPA's withdrawal in mid-January could expose upwards of 100,000 people to possible cancer-causing radiation. The state strategy for the site in Lakeland, Florida, is to monitor radon levels in a housing subdivision but not remove any hazardous soils. Phosphate industry lobbyists firmly opposed the Superfund cleanup designation, which could have made the corporations involved liable for an $11 billion toxic cleanup. In the past, state health officials have maintained that no cleanup was necessary unless radon exposures exceeded 500 millirems of radiation a year, levels well above what the EPA would normally permit. The EPA decision to pull back from a Superfund cleanup in Lakeland is consistent with controversial new guidelines to deal with exposure to dirty bombs, nuclear power plant meltdowns, and other radiological incidents that is being pushed by the nuclear power industry as a means of relaxing radiation standards. Daniel Hirsch, an authority on nuclear power at the University of California, Santa Cruz, states, "The EPA's approach to the Lakeland case is an indication that the agency is backing away from its long-held radiological cleanup rules." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
On Tuesday, March 11th, California Democratic Senator and Chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein, made an unexpected and dramatic speech. In her remarks made from the Senate floor, Feinstein accused the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency of conducting a long campaign of obstruction with the goal of covering up the agency's illegal post-9/11 torture program. She described the current conflict between her committee and the CIA as a defining moment for political oversight of the U.S. Intelligence Service. The Senate began investigating the Bush administration's CIA torture program of post-9/11 detainees in December 2007. After President Obama took office in January 2009, an expanded bipartisan investigation was launched, but Obama-appointed CIA Director Leon Panetta impeded the Senate review. When the Senate Intelligence Committee completed its 6,300-page investigation report, the CIA objected to its public release, claiming there were major inaccuracies. But a suppressed internal document, known as the Panetta Review, directly contradicted the CIA's criticism of the Senate report. Senator Feinstein charges that the CIA hacked into computers used by Senate staff investigators and says that the agency has deliberately withheld and destroyed information critical to understanding the Bush detention and interrogation program. The CIA, for its part, recently referred charges to the Justice Department, claiming that Senate staffers stole classified documents. Your reporter spoke with Ray McGovern, a retired 27-year veteran CIA officer who during his career briefed Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush before leaving the agency in 1990. Here McGovern discusses the current conflict between the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee and the CIA, amid growing concern that the spy agency is now a power unto itself beyond executive branch or congressional accountability.
It's a deal here where Congress, who's supposed to be overseeing the CIA, is kind of playing a reverse game here with the CIA overseeing what Congress is doing. In a word, Feinstein learned that the CIA was messing around with the staffers that she had working on this torture report, and that it was withholding some information, that it was withdrawing information already made available. And in the meantime, we learned that the president himself, the White House, has withheld thousands and thousands of documents having to do with torture. Now, people remember that our country and most civilized countries always regarded as torture as beyond the pale. And when you include things like waterboarding, well, ipso facto, is torture, has always been regarded as torture ever since the Inquisition 500 years ago, okay? Well, after 9/11, everything changed. How often have you heard that phrase? Everything changed when Dick Cheney and George Bush said, well, we're going to give these captives the business. And I don't care, as George Bush famously said, I don't care what the international lawyers say, we're going to kick some ass. Now, the ironic thing here about torture is not only is it morally wrong, but it doesn't work. Despite what you see on television and the movies, it doesn't work.
Ray McGovern, President Obama, directly and through his spokesperson, has said that he's not going to get mired in the conflict between the Senate Intelligence Committee and his appointed CIA director, John Brennan. But in your view, what is the president's role here in getting this information revealed to the public in terms of the policies that led to torture, which is illegal under U.S. law as well as international law? What could or should he be doing at this point?
Well, what he should be doing is what he should have done 5 years ago and pursued these gross violators of international and national law. But that would have meant going up the line to a fellow named George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, a series of attorneys general who are all implicated in this. And Obama is not the kind of guy who's going to take this task on. You could say he's weak. I think he's afraid. And, you know, my attitude to that is if you're going to be this toady, if he's going to be this afraid, if, for example, he really thinks that he and his family are in physical danger from these folks, which I have reason to believe he does feel, then he shouldn't have tried to be president, because you can't run a government if you're afraid of your own security sources, your own security organs. And he gives every evidence to me of being afraid of John Brennan, of General Keith Alexander, the head of NSA, and, of course, of James Clapper, former general, who now is the National Intelligence Director. Clapper lied under oath exactly a year ago, 12th of March, 2013. He said, no, the NSA is not spying, is not collecting any manner of information on any Americans. Well, he threw his teeth. Later, he apologized to the Senate and said, well, I said something that was clearly erroneous, and I'm really sorry. Well, hello, he's still head of national intelligence.
During the 70s, Congress convened the Church Committee, which did expose a lot of the wrongdoing by the CIA. Is it time for another Church Committee to be formed, given what's come out in the open, these allegations of spying on Congress?
I agree. The only problem is, if you look at the Congress, I'm hard-pressed to find a senator of the caliber and courage of Frank Church. So, yeah, that's clearly what needs to happen. But, you know, I'd be very happy to have it happen, but doesn't look like anything like that is in the offing. Things will continue to fester, and more people will get more people in trouble, but not accountable.
That was Ray McGovern, a retired 27-year veteran CIA officer who later founded the group Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Visit our Between the Lines website, where you can find links to more analysis and commentary on the Senate-CIA conflict and Bush administration torture program. A day after the reported overwhelming and controversial 97% vote of Crimeans favoring a split from Ukraine and joining the Russian Federation, the crisis in Ukraine is now moving to another phase, where both the U.S. and European Union have imposed limited economic sanctions against some prominent Russian officials. Despite Western condemnation of the Crimean vote as illegal and illegitimate, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced that Russia would officially reunify with Crimea, but said his nation had no further designs on other parts of Ukraine. Just before the secession referendum took place, the Crimean government said its self-defense forces had seized a natural gas terminal just outside Crimea's border because Ukraine had turned off the fuel supply, leaving residents without heat or electricity. And not long after the votes were counted, Crimea's recently installed pro-Russian parliament moved to nationalize the assets of Ukrainian state property, including several state-owned oil companies. These recent events underscore the importance that energy issues play in the politics and economics surrounding the current Ukraine crisis. While Ukraine and many European nations depend on Russian natural gas for their energy, one-third of Russia's oil and gas pipelines cross Ukrainian territory to reach European markets and earn Moscow billions in income. The energy interdependence of Western Europe and Russia on each other would seem to undermine the willingness of both sides to endure a long conflict with escalating sanctions. Your reporter spoke with Ken Bosong, executive director of the Sunday Campaign, a nonprofit research and educational organization that promotes sustainable energy technologies. Here, Bosong talks about the current crisis in Ukraine and assesses the credibility of U.S. politicians and energy companies' call to address the Ukraine crisis by fast-tracking construction of American liquefied natural gas export terminals and encourage fracking Ukrainian shale formations for natural gas.
It is true that about a third of the oil and gas that go into the EU comes from Russia through pipeline network that crisscrosses Ukraine. What's important to also realize, however, is that the oil and gas that comes to those pipelines accounts for only about a quarter of the energy that's being used in the EU. The EU also relies on sources of their own and imports from other places. So in reality, the energy coming through Ukraine to the EU counts maybe 6 to 8% of the total energy used in the European Union. Significant, but not overwhelming. And that's important just because to the extent that energy is being used as a political weapon, it's not as significant a weapon as many people are concerned that it could be. As far as Ukraine itself is concerned, Ukraine, due to a host of very bad political decisions made since independence 22 years ago, has remained heavily dependent on Russia, not only for oil and gas, but also for nuclear fuel. Approximately 60 to 70% of the natural gas consumed in Ukraine comes from Russia. A roughly comparable percentage of its oil also comes from Russia. And fully all of the nuclear fuel used in the country's nuclear power plant is enriched in Russia. Doesn't have to be. And I've done calculations in the past which indicate that if Ukraine, through efficiency measures, simply reduced its energy use, it could actually eliminate fully 100% of all the imports from Russia and from most other sources.
Ken, the U.S. response to the crisis in Ukraine has seen politicians in Washington calling for the speeding up the construction of liquid natural gas export terminals on American East and West coasts. Further, there's talk about helping the Ukraine government exploit shale oil deposits underground there. Is what we're hearing out of Washington and from some big oil companies a real solution to problems there, or is it really just exploiting the current crisis to speed up permits to do things that may not have been possible otherwise to ram through the permitting process?
The proposals that are coming from the oil and gas companies in the United States are not completely ridiculous, but they should be taken with a very large grain of salt for a whole host of reasons, which I'll mention. If you read the media in the United States very superficially, you would be led to believe that the United States has a surplus of oil and gas that we could ship over to Europe or to Ukraine to help in the current crisis. And that is factually not correct. The United States is a net importer of both natural gas and oil. We currently import about a third of our oil and between 5 and 6% of our natural gas. If we were to export some of our domestically produced resources, that would mean we would have to import oil and gas from other sources to replace it. In effect, what we'd be doing is selling our domestic supplies at a low price and importing it at a high price. And it makes no economic sense to sell low and buy high, which is what we would end up doing. More importantly, however, physically it's not possible to get natural gas, at least directly, to Ukraine using LNG. There are no LNG facilities currently in Ukraine. Ukraine had been exploring building one or more on the Black Sea, but it has not yet done so. So there's no place for us to actually export natural gas directly into Ukraine. Moreover, if an LNG facility was to be built, it would almost certainly have to be built on the Black Sea, which effectively now is a war zone because Russia has invaded the Crimea. It's also actually invaded into Ukraine proper, into an area called Kherson. And building an LNG facility in what is, if not a fighting zone, a potential war zone, is at best risky, if not just plain foolish. Another concern is that even if an LNG facility could be built, the gas would have to go through the Strait of Bosphorus that is controlled by Turkey. And Turkey is basically saying no for two reasons. One, the straits are currently over-prescribed for ships trying to go through. And Turkey has a particular concern with allowing natural gas, liquefied natural gas, to go through the straits because it's a safety factor. So you'd have to negotiate with Turkey to even change its policies before you can get gas into an LNG facility that doesn't yet exist in Ukraine. There may be some option for shipping American gas to Europe and utilize one of the LNG facilities in Europe. But then that would mean that the gas would have to go to Ukraine by reversing the flow in the gas pipelines that crisscross Europe. Right now, the gas goes from east to west, and we would have to instead then have the pipelines reverse the flow from west to east. It's technically doable, but nonetheless it is an additional barrier to accomplishing that. So for all those reasons, certainly in the short term, it's not practical. Economically, it's questionable. Long term, it may not be doable as well. And if you have to make a choice, it would make more sense, if we're talking about the next 6, 12 months, 2 years, to invest heavily in getting Ukraine to reduce its dependence on natural gas rather than trying to get new supplies into the country.
That was Ken Bosong, executive director of the Sunday campaign, who served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Ukraine from 2000 to 2003. Find links to more news and information on Ukraine's energy issues by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens has a book coming out in April titled Six Amendments, How and Why We Should Change the Constitution. In it, he argues for an end to political gerrymandering, granting elected officials immunity from prosecution and the death penalty. He advocates changing the Second Amendment to include language that states people have the right to bear arms when serving in the militia, which he maintains was the original intent. Justice Stevens also recommends adding a new plank to the Constitution, which states, neither the First Amendment nor any other provision of this Constitution shall be construed to prohibit the Congress or any state from imposing reasonable limits on the amount of money that candidates for public office or their supporters may spend in election campaigns. When he retired in 2010, John Paul Stevens was the second longest-serving justice in the history of the Supreme Court. Some critics say it's a violation of judicial ethics for Stevens, who technically remains an Article III judge, albeit an inactive one, to publicly call for constitutional change. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with John Bonifaz, an attorney, co-founder, and executive director of Free Speech for People, a nonprofit group founded the day the Citizens United case was decided by the Supreme Court in January 2010. The Citizens United decision held that money is speech and corporations and unions are legal persons who can use their money as speech. Here, Bonifaz explains why he supports Justice Stevens' call for constitutional change, focusing on campaign finance reform, and how his book fits into a people-powered movement to amend the Constitution in this arena.
There's significant developments with this on a number of fronts. First, it's, of course, rare for a current or former Supreme Court justice to call for a constitutional amendment. So it's significant that Justice Stevens is calling for these six amendments, one of which would overhaul our nation's campaign finance system. He was not part of the ruling in Buckley v. Valeo in 1976 that equated money with speech and set us on this course of unlimited campaign spending. But he has been very clear in his concurring and dissenting opinions since that time that the ruling was wrongly decided. In fact, in a 2000 campaign finance ruling, he wrote in a concurring opinion that money is property, it is not speech. And he's been vocal about that even outside of his court opinions. But this, I believe, is the first time that he is publicly calling for a constitutional amendment to overturn that ruling and make clear that Congress and the states have the authority to set reasonable limits on overall campaign spending, which would do away with this current system we have of unlimited campaign spending where our elections are up to the highest bidders. It's not necessary, of course, to put that language in the amendment. He doesn't do that, but anyone following this jurisprudence knows that that amendment would overturn Buckley v. Valeo, because it was Buckley where the court first stated that the First Amendment protects those who want to spend up to the sky, you know, in their campaigns or in independent expenditures. And that set us on this course that, of course, led to Citizens United, where we now have not only enabled wealthy individuals, mega wealthy individuals, to spend money in campaigns, but we've now enabled these artificial creatures of the state, corporations, to engage in these expenditures. And, of course, Justice Stevens is well known today for being the dissenter in that case. He wrote the 90-page dissent for the other dissenting justices. It was a 5-4 ruling, and it really has been celebrated by many in the democracy movement as being on the right side of history and one that is a clarion call for why the overall ruling should be overturned.
John Boniface, I read an interesting comment about this from a blogger, Josh Blackman, who writes on legal issues at his self-named blog. He said he thought it was inappropriate for Justice Stevens to write a book about amendments he thinks should be enacted because, you know, even though he's retired from the Supreme Court, he's still a judge who could be called on some cases. So, I guess he's not fully retired. I was surprised when I saw that he had written this book, and this certainly couldn't come from a sitting Supreme Court justice, right?
Well, look, I'm not necessarily going to make a comment whether it should come from a sitting Supreme Court justice. I will say that we're facing a crisis in our democracy today, and we need the voices of all Americans, including those in the judiciary, to help address that crisis. And at the core of that crisis is this dominance of big money over our politics and our elections. So I think Justice Stevens should be celebrated for standing up and calling for this amendment. And, you know, it's not done in a vacuum. There is a vibrant constitutional amendment movement that's been underway since the Citizens United ruling. 16 states are on record calling for this kind of an amendment, 500 cities and towns. And the president has gone on record along with 125-plus members of Congress. And there is, in fact, an amendment bill that would do exactly what Justice Stevens proposes by Senator Tom Udall and Congressman Jim McGovern, already having 29 Senate co-sponsors. So ultimately, I think Justice Stevens will be seen as having lent a very important voice to this overall movement, and he will, I think, be recognized in history as being on the right side.
That was John Boniface, executive director of the group Free Speech for People. For more news and commentary on campaign finance reform and Justice Stevens' new book, which will be published in April, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.